starting chapter 4, verse 1 through 9, and it's one idea, okay? The only thing is there's an introduction and a postscript, and then there's one pasuk, you know what I mean? That's the essence of the whole thing, okay? So he starts, listen, children, the mussar of your father. Over here means listen to the mussar of your father means a God. Okay, Muslim version, I mean, it could be many different possibilities. Muslim version, say God. Bakshiva ladas bina, and listen to the knowledge of bina. In other words, the ultimate is bina. Bina is creativity. Okay, being creative. We'll come back to bina. Okay? He says, because, in other words, that's the that is the purpose, okay, of all learning, is that you should become creative. Because the good teaching I've given to you, to Rossi al Tazovu, my Torah, don't leave it. So since God is speaking, so he's talking, he says, don't leave my Torah, okay? Now the word Torah could mean the... the five, like the Chumash, you understand? Or it could mean Musa. I don't know exactly what subject, whatever. Okay, fine. Kivena Yisi La'avi Rach V'yachid, because I was a son to my father, and in other words, the favorite son. Doesn't say that, but that's what the commentaries say. Soft meaning young. Rach means soft, like young. V'yachid. And the only child before my mother. So he says, I was a favorite and my mother's only child. So the question is, why is this is King Solomon already, right? So the question is, why is King Solomon pointing this out? He says, because what I'm going to tell you is totally contrary to all your desires. So you think I'm trying to hurt you. I'm trying to tell you to stop the enjoyments of life. Says, I want you to know I was the favorite of my father, and I was my mother's only child. I was really spoiled. I was protected, right? And this is what they gave me. This is what they've guided me. In other words, I'm going to tell you something that is going to be contrary to all your desires. In other words, right? All right. Now, the thing is, so you think that I'm going to talk against all your desires, that I'm out to hurt you, right? So he says, you should know that this is what my parents did, and I was the favorite of my father, and I was my mother's only child, like I could have been really spoiled. And this is what they guided me in this area. Even though it runs against the emotions, I'm telling you, don't think that I'm out to hurt you, because I'm out to benefit you. My parents definitely wouldn't have hurt me. They would have spoiled me. And then this is the things that they told me. Okay? Verse 4, and they guided me, and they said to me, let my words sustain or support your heart. Keep my commandments and live. Okay, commandments could either mean the commandments of the Torah or the commandment of the father telling the child how to live their life. Okay. Verse 5. This is still part of the introduction. All right, now this is a little closer. Okay, that was very general to tell you that I'm trying to benefit you. Now he says, what is the thing that is so much against your emotions? Acquire wisdom. Okay? Acquire wisdom, acquire bina. Okay? Those are the two things you should acquire. And chachma is what you get from other people. Bina is where you're creative. Okay? That, in other words, whenever you're going to do something, the first thing is you must have a goal. You must know why you're doing it. Why am I doing this? Okay? So he says, you're doing this to acquire wisdom and creativity. Knowledge and creativity. Okay? That is the purpose. That's the purpose of this book. Okay? One of the purposes. Okay? He says, don't forget this and don't turn from the words of my mouth. Don't turn away an inch. Okay? Then in verse 6 he says, don't turn away. So now he explains, don't leave it and it will protect you. Love it and it will, it's also a type of protection, okay? It's also, one is guard, one is protection. It's two synonyms for guarding you. The pasuk saying the same thing, that this is your protection in life. Okay? Okay. All that was the introduction, and the essence of the perek is in verse 7. It says, the beginning of wisdom is to acquire wisdom, and all your acquisitions, and with all your acquisitions, acquire bina. Bina is creativity. The question is, what does it mean, the beginning of wisdom is to acquire wisdom? Well, what does that mean? Of course, I mean, that's what we do. The thing is that there is a mistake that people make. When you start a science, they sit you down, for instance, in Gemara. I know a lot of people sit you down to learn Gemara. No introduction. Yeah, sit down, just go to Gemara. But some people will start their geometry without an introduction. They'll just start with the propositions and just give the proofs. And that's it, without an introduction. Says, the first thing is the first introduction to all knowledge is an introduction to each particular science. You should not start a science without understanding the introduction. And two, there's an introduction to all sciences, and that is the training of the mind. Training of the mind is you must get from somebody else. You must get from, you must have a teacher that guides you. You can't get it on your own. You must find a teacher. That is the idea, that is one of the ideas, not the total idea, but one of the ideas of the Masorah, the transmission from Mount Sinai, is not only a transmission of information, but it's a transmission of methodology, of how to think, training of the mind. Okay? And so therefore the first stage is to find a teacher and to open your mind to think correctly. Okay? That does not mean that you accept the teacher blindly. In other words, you must be able to understand what the teacher says. And if you have any questions, if you have any doubts, then you shouldn't accept it until all questions and all doubts are removed. In other words, your mind must see the idea. If your mind does not see the idea, then it's, insofar as thinking is concerned, it's worthless. It's totally worthless. You understand? Insofar as the training of the mind is concerned, when you choose the teacher, you must be able to question. And the ability to question will develop as your mind develops, but you should not accept anything until the mind sees it. I'm not talking like, for instance, in halacha, that's something else. Okay? If the person that's making decisions says, jump, I ask how high. If he says, build the sukkah, I say, what are the measurements? I don't ask why. I don't ask how. But however, when it comes to the training of the mind, you must ask every question and enunciate every doubt. You understand? Until the question and doubts are totally removed from your mind. Okay? Then that is chachma. Chachma is not only that I accept the teacher. It must be that my mind sees clearly what the teacher is saying. If not, then it's unacceptable. The question is, how do I get it from the pasuk? He says, because the beginning of wisdom, in other words, having wisdom, is to acquire wisdom. Now, what do you mean acquire wisdom? It means thinking. In other words, the acquisition of wisdom is through the mind. Is through the mind. And therefore, you must learn how to acquire wisdom. That takes a training. The beginning of wisdom is training the mind how to acquire wisdom. In other words, it says the beginning of wisdom is to acquire wisdom. Like you yourself said, what's the big deal? Of course. What else? I mean, of course that's true. What it means is that the beginning of wisdom is to spend time on the methodology of wisdom itself, how you acquire wisdom. What does it mean to acquire wisdom? To acquire wisdom is where your mind sees it without a question. In other words, sometimes you're in class and you don't have any questions. It seems to be clear. Somebody asks the question and say, "Hey, that's right. That's a good question," which means that you have to open your mind to think of these questions. Sometimes you think something is 100% when really it's not. That also takes a certain amount of time to develop your questions until it becomes clear to the mind. That in itself is a development, how to question, how to know when you're in doubt, and how to express when you're in doubt or you don't understand, how to formulate the question. Many times you don't even know how to formulate the question. That's also part of the acquisition of knowledge. The formulation of the question, how to formulate the question. Right, the question is that what is there about wisdom that a person has a mind, and why does he need a teacher to train his mind? Why can't he do it himself? Okay, the first thing you have to know is Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, in his introduction to logic, says like this. He says that that there are certain things in this world that they come about on their own, that they are in nature. Like, for instance, there is out there fruit trees that produce fruit. But however, the quality and quantity of fruit, if you really want good quality and quantity of fruit, then you have to add to nature. You have to work on nature. You have to benefit nature. You understand? In fact, he wants to make a whole universal over in there, that all of nature was created incomplete. God created incomplete, and he gave it over to the human being to complete it. And that you see in reality. I mean, a car, a plane, and trees, like you see, different things that could have been there originally, and God did not. He gave us the potential, but then he gave it over to the human being, take responsibility for himself, and as he sees he needs certain things, so he'll use the physical world to create things for his own benefit. So he says the same thing with the mind. The mind on its own will see certain things, okay? But he says there is no comparison between the natural mind and the trained mind. Okay? Now, the thing is when you are thinking, how do you know that you can go further, that you can clarify? In other words, in thought itself, there are many, many mistakes, and there are many steps. In other words, whether you could go deeper, whether it's deep enough, you understand? Like, things like that. What the teacher does is his years of thinking, that he got it from his teacher, and his years of training of thinking, so he's able to show you that you are missing. In other words, it is possible that in 20 years you'll be able to create some of the shiurim, some of the classes that your rebbes give you in Talmud and all different areas. But however, you would not see it now, and you would not notice that you can go further. The natural mind would think, but you would stop at a certain step. You would not know to go further. You will not know if you made a mistake. You see? But as you see from the teacher, he opens your mind, so then you notice, yeah, I wouldn't have gone that way. Why did he go that way? What did he see to go that way? So you start making the comparison and start thinking about what you missed and how you should go. In other words, I'm going in this direction to the left. He moves totally to the right. My mind goes this way and his mind goes that way. Why am I wrong? And what is wrong? Like I said, you must know exactly what you're doing wrong. It's not a matter to accept that the teacher is right and you're wrong. You must say, what is he doing? Why is he right? Why is he right? And why am I wrong? But that opens the mind, and that guides you. If you did it, first of all, if you did it on your own, even assuming you can do it on your own, which I'm not sure, then you're going to spend so many years in working it out that was already worked out that you're losing all that time. And I'm not sure you could do it, because there's too many mistakes that you could make. And then when you need the teacher to constantly compare, why does he go here? Why do I go here? What have made him think of that? What did I do wrong? Just one example. I mean, Rabbi Chaik was one time giving a class, and we had the question, and he was creating. You know, we were working it out together. In other words, it was Sukkos, you know, in the morning, Chatzi Hashem. So we're working together, he didn't prepare. So we had the question, working on the question. Half hour later, he comes up with another question. Comes up with a different question. Second question led to the answer. So I asked them, anyway, how did he think of that question? We're working on the answer. He says, the thing is you're working on the answer, you shouldn't work on the answer. He says, he didn't put it that way. He says, he was working on the phenomenon. He just allowed the facts to keep going around in his mind and thinking about it from different angles. He wasn't working on an answer. Now, here's a simple idea of how to think. Do you understand? Right away, the emotion is the ego, so you want the answer. So you have a question, you're looking for the answer. What's the rush? Enjoy the facts. Go back to the facts. Maybe you'll see something new in the facts. Go back to the phenomena. Let it roll around your mind and let it guide you. And you'll see more questions, and the more questions you'll see, that's the guide. A question is a guide. In other words, many times if people are afraid of questions because it gets you stuck. You feel it's like a weapon. Somebody's trapping you. But no, the question is a guide, and the better the question, the better the answer. And so therefore you go back to the phenomenon. If you can't find an answer, it means you don't have the right question. You need a better question. So you got to go back to the phenomenon. You understand? Now here's a simple idea. How many people would think of an idea like this in their life? You understand? And even if they would, they lost out so much time. Here's a simple idea that would help a person in his development. But you must understand, in other words, if he comes to a question, why am I doing it different? Why didn't I think of that question? What am I doing different? You see? Now here he was able to explain the answer. It was a method that helped me personally, and I'm sure many students that I've helped with this idea. I mean, tremendous amount of people. It's a simple idea. You understand? Now, the question is, does everybody have the capability to work out his mind to think of all questions? The answer is no. The answer is that there are two things to develop the mind. One is there's a natural ability, that each person is different. In other words, you will not be as creative as Einstein unless you have that ability. He's a very unique person that had a special, not only was he creative, but somebody one time defined his creativity that he has the ability to look at something as if he didn't live before. You know what I mean? As if he came down from Mars and looking at something, no prejudgment. We have a certain amount of view of life that interferes with our creativity. You understand that we have a certain view of life, and it interferes with our creativity because it's already, we prejudge the situation already. His ability was that he came to look at any facts without any prejudgment at all, like totally like a new thing. That's an amazing thing. That's a very hard thing to do. But the thing is, he naturally did that, and then with work, he developed it. He saw that was the right way, and he constantly developed it. So you must have a certain type of level of creativity, and then you will, then you can develop it. But you can't develop something you don't have, so your level of ability, each person is different. Now the second here. He says, and with all your possessions, acquire creativity. Okay? So the Meiri says, what is possessions? What does it mean, possessions? It says, first of all, there's mental possessions, then there's emotional possessions, and then there's physical possessions. You see? He says, you must put all your energy that you have into it. Everything, in other words, for chachma, for wisdom, I mean, there's a certain amount of energy that you need to gain from the teacher, certain amount of thinking. But for creativity, there's you have to be creative, you have to put everything in it. You must put in it everything that you got from your teacher. Everything that became, what I mean by what you got from your teacher, not to remember this or that, what your teacher said, but that it's second nature, that it's a part of you. You must be able to make sure your emotions don't interfere with your thinking process. You understand? Once you become creative, their emotions have the ability to get in there more than by chachma, because by chachma, you see clearly what the teacher is saying, and then you try to understand what he's saying. But here you're being creative. Here's where the emotions could sneak in. You understand? And two, all your money, even if you had to lose your money, in other words, the desire must be all your energy in the world of learning. It doesn't mean you should throw out your money. It means that even if you're going to lose money, or you're going to make less money, or you're going to live on a lower standard, to be able to learn, okay? You have to be careful one thing here, though. In other words, there are people that their needs of the physical world are different. And if you do not take care of your physical needs, what you must have, then you won't be able to learn. You won't be satisfied. You won't be able to learn. You won't be able to be creative. So there has to go, you have to evaluate what my needs are, what I must have, what's the bottom line, and give up everything else. Now, how much you could give up, some people could give up more. And maybe you could give up a certain amount today. Tomorrow, as you develop and as you gain a love for learning, you might be able to give up more. You understand? But the thing is, you have to be careful. You must satisfy certain needs, because if you don't, you won't be able to learn at all. So you have to know yourself. But you must be able to bring together all these things. In other words, when you come to Chachma, you only need the natural mind and relate it to the teacher. Well, you understand, and see what the teacher comes to, what you come to, and how you're different, and the ideas that he tells you. That's all you have to do. That's just the mind. But to be creative, that you need the total being involved. the total being has to be involved in creativity. Okay? So one of the problems, one is in thinking itself, so all the training that you got must be second nature. And the emotions shouldn't interfere with the, you have to make sure that the emotions don't interfere, and you have to desire it more than your lifestyle. In other words, you should be able to lower your lifestyle for that, be able to give up the physical to be able to get to the, to gain and to be creative. The question is, what is the activity of being creative? Basically, is that, in other words, creativity is I can't give you a method in creativity. You understand? Because the thing is, what is creativity? I'm asking you a question that you don't know the answer. So I can't tell you how. There's no method in how to get that answer. What happens is, within you, there's a certain intuition from all the years of learning that just come forward, okay, when you have the question, so then the creativity works somehow. We don't know what it is. What it is, it just comes forward. There's no method. Yeah, you have a method for creativity, it can't be true. It's impossible. It's not creativity. Creativity means that you have a question that you don't know, and you go over the phenomenon, and you review the phenomenon, and then somehow you come up with an answer. We don't know how. We could, afterwards, the work is checking out the answer to make sure the answer is right. So all I could tell you is what situation you need to be able to be creative. One is, you must train the mind, you must get a teacher to train the mind to the best as possible. Okay? Two is, you can't allow emotions to interfere. And three is, you must be totally involved. By total, I mean what your ability of involvement is. Let's say your total ability of involvement is 2 hours a day. That is your ability, you put it all in. If you could make it 3 hours, you would, but you can't. You wouldn't be able to think clearly. You wouldn't be able to be creative. You understand? If you overdo it, you have to know who and what you are. Some people can work 18 hours a day and they're creative all day. You understand? Some people are not. You have to know who you are, what your needs are, to be able only for the purpose of being creative. You have to work that out. You see? And there has to be a love for this, because if you just want answers, if that's all your desire is, then you won't be creative, and you won't put in all the work that you can. In other words, if it's the same as school, that you just go for the grade, then you'll only put in that amount of energy to get an answer. You understand? But if you're really interested in the truth, and the real development of the being as a total, then you must put in all your energy into this. And even if you need enjoyment outside, then you should take it and recognize that this is what I need so I could be creative. Like, everything is towards that. Hey, the question is, let's say, for instance, a person puts in time and energy into creativity, but he really doesn't put all. He still has a pull other places, and that other things are important. It's not a, you understand, it's not like there's one guy that has a need for physical things, but so he gives into it because he won't be able to be creative. There's another person that has a drive for other things, okay? So the question is, maybe his creativity will be a little bit less. And that's it. Maybe it's a matter of quantity. And here he's saying, and no, like, you won't have it. That's the question. What I think King Solomon is saying is this, that creativity, to be creative, it's not a matter of just the mind. See, a lot of people think, your question is based on my mind. that I need my mind, and I use my mind, which is a certain amount of energy, and so therefore I'll be creative. And so therefore that's the way we usually think of creativity. What King Solomon is saying is that creativity comes from the essence of the person, from the total being of the person. And therefore, if there's energy out of it, and there's energy pulling him in a different direction, then the creativity will not be, in other words, coming directly from him. It's not totally the total being. Okay, we'll try another angle. The thing is that, but we'll try to explain that last point. The thing is, let's say, for instance, what we said, creativity is something you don't know what it is or how it works. Well, you know how to bring about creativity, but we don't know what it is. You understand? We know the situation to bring it about, but we don't know, we can't define what creativity is. Okay? Now, let's say, for instance, I put in a lot of work in all the facts and all the phenomena, and I don't have an answer. So what do I do? So one researcher said what he does is he goes for a bike ride, goes sailing. You understand? What does it mean? It means you have to allow the intuition to take over. And sometimes it takes certain amounts of time for the intuition to put together all the information, and then it comes forward to the mind. You have to allow it to come. You see? That much we do see. You can't force it because you don't know what you're forcing. So all you could do is keep going over the phenomenon until it comes. You understand? Till it comes, right? But if you're drawn to something else during that time, in other words, you are just letting yourself sit and do nothing. Is that correct? Now, therefore, the energy will be pulled in a different direction. There's a certain amount of energy being pulled in a different direction. The question is, if I'm putting my, when I try to put myself, if I get through with all the information, and I just wait for it to come. So he says, what about bike riding? Am I putting energy in that? Or anything else I do, whatever I do, I'm going to be putting energy in that. The answer is like this. When you're driving, let's say for instance drive, or even when you're biking, once you know how to do the activity, your eyes are watching where you're going. You have a certain amount of energy there, but basically your mind is totally free. Like for instance, you could talk, and you'll notice if there's something there. In other words, the mind is free, basically, to operate. You're not drawn. In other words, if you're drawn psychologically and drawn and you give things into the other things that you're drawn to. In other words, like an addiction. In other words, I'm talking about where learning is an addiction, where this is your total life. You're drawn to it. You understand? I have to do other things in life, but those other things are not pulling away from my wisdom. But where I'm attached to something, where there's an addiction to something other than learning, then it's drawing energy from the learning itself. It has to, you see? And therefore, the creativity, you might be creative, but it would not be on the level where you could pull away your energy from other areas. In other words, even let's say, for instance, a person can only learn 2 hours a day. So even when he does the other things, his real desire is to get back into learning. But he knows that he can't. So he goes out and he enjoys himself. But in other words, there's two different types of enjoyments. There's enjoyments where I put all my energy where I'm drawn to it. And there's enjoyments that, I enjoy doing it. In other words, let's put it this way. I think the ancients called it the loud pleasures and the quiet pleasures. The loud pleasures are the pleasures that draw you. You understand? You go to a amusement park. Like, you get, wow, the excitement, it draws you. Yeah, I'm just going to say with certain people, especially kids. You understand? I'm not saying it has to be that way. You go to amusement park and you can enjoy yourself, you understand? But in general, you understand, there's certain things that draw people, that they become like, help all their energy into it. You see, the person that we're talking about is energy, all his energy is in life, is involved in the world of ideas, you see, but he has emotions in other areas, so it's like a passive thing, but he has to do it, he needs the outlet, you understand? But he is not, it doesn't draw him. It doesn't draw him. He does it, and he enjoys it. There's an enjoyment. You should enjoy it. Because if you don't enjoy it, then you don't have a real outlet. You won't be able to be a creative either. So you must have an outlet for your enjoyments. You understand? But the thing is that afterwards you come back, the real, what you really want, and in time, as you enjoy learning, you will be able to put more time. And the other pleasures will fall by the wayside. It's a slow process. The question is, if a person, by creativity, you need your emotions evolved. But what about by learning, even by chachma, the first stage, by what you get from a teacher, I mean, your emotions could also stop you from learning. Okay? The answer is like this. In the first half, if emotions are stopping you from learning, then you must deal with those emotions that stop you from learning. That's no question about it. In the second half is the being, who you are, whether your energy is all into learning or the energy is away. If you have something stopping you from learning, of course that's the first stage you have to deal with. That's in the chachma. That's just a practical thing. Yeah, right. The first is practical. But in creativity, it's what we're saying is inherent and part of creativity is you must have all a total involvement in creativity. Right, the question is that for chachma you need a teacher. What about for bina, for creativity? Do you need a teacher there? So the thing is, for me, the way I understand it, no. All you need is a teacher if for some reason in your creativity you don't know how to operate. In other words, like you get to a certain situation and somehow there's something missing. So you call up your Rebbe and ask him for guidance. In other words, the guidance of the Rebbe should only be in the methodology. There's something missing and you don't know how to handle it. In other words, there's a lot of people, whenever they have a question, they call the teacher for the answer. That's not what the person that's creative, he calls the, sometimes he has to ask for answers and halachas or anything. But insofar as creativity is concerned, he has to, in other words, it has to be a methodology. There's something missing, and he doesn't know how to approach it. So therefore, he needs a certain amount of methodology. If he can't work it out himself, sometimes you have enough chachma to work out the methodology yourself. But if you don't have enough chachma to work out the methodology yourself, so then you have to ask the teacher. We said that for creativity you need everything you got from your teacher. I'd like to clarify that. Okay? And that is this. There was a very wise person that he says that you should learn methodology from the ancients. Okay? His ancients were different than ours. Okay, but anyway. And then he said that you should take the methods that you learned from the ancients and then question the very methods that you accepted before because you had to be trained, then take the training of the mind that they gave you to question the training. You understand? So he says, and that will open up many, many new ideas and new methods. Okay, so the thing is when we talk about creativity, it doesn't only mean from the teacher, but it's who you are plus all the knowledge that made you who you are, plus your own intuition. I mean, how that knowledge affects you is going to be different than the teacher, you see? And so therefore, you will start having, then all your thoughts will be only what you see from your mind and not what you accept from anybody else. And that'll, you're right. When you're acquiring Bina, that's continuation of your training as you're being creative. In other words, let's say you're working on a subject like Gemara, math, Chumash, whatever you're working on. So then you're going to go over the methods and to think back after you thought it through what you did, and then you're going to keep developing and working out more things on your own. Even in your training of the mind, you'll be developing more. Okay? The question is that Shlomo HaMelech, in his introduction that we just read, said that you have to, that this is going to run against your emotions. Okay? Now, the question is, insofar as creativity is concerned, so from what we see, yeah, you have to give up everything for that, okay? But what about for Chachma? How does that run against your emotions? The answer is that the nature of a person is not to develop his mind. The nature of a person is to enjoy life. You understand? I one time heard an interesting interpretation. It says by Paro when Israel had started multiplying, so they felt there was a problem. That they gathered his ministers and had a meeting. You know what I mean? An emergency meeting of this about the Jews that were growing so much that they were. So they said, "Hava nischachma lo." Let us wisen to him. Now, in Jewish grammar, there is different levels of called the binyan. Okay, there is. Let's say, for instance, I broke a glass. That's one type of binyan. The glass was broken. Is a second type. Basic. Then I smashed the glass, and the glass was smashed. That's four. Okay. The fifth, that's four, right. Now, the fifth one is I cause you to do something. Like, for instance, a secretary is hifil. Hifil is I cause her to write. You understand? And then there's the passive of that I was caused to write, or she was caused to write. He was supposed to write, okay? The last one is his ta'el, is I have to force myself to do something I don't want to do. You see? Like, for instance, when I get up in the morning, I don't feel like getting up, so I have to force myself to get up. You see? So he says, you see, that they didn't enjoy thinking. When there was a situation, let us force ourselves to think, to go against our natures, to think, so therefore we'll be able to do it. You see, most people, it's not that they force themselves to think for school, for a practical thing, for business, but otherwise most people don't enjoy thinking. How many people do you meet that really enjoy thinking, that want to spend time training their minds to think, even though they don't need to, you know what I mean, for business or for whatever it is they need it for. So the thing is that, no, it runs against your emotions. That totally runs against what you are. Sal Saleha Usaroma Mecca. Lift it up, and you will, and it will raise you. Give it honor, and it will take you, will like hug you, become part of you. Alright? The word Sal Saleha, lifted up, Rashi quotes another place where basically it means to go back again and again. The pasuk over there was saying that God is speaking to the enemies of Israel when he wanted to punish Israel. So he says, go back and Sal Saleha, rip it up. Tear up the shoots, you know, take them up again, and then come back again, rip it up again. So Rashi wants to attach that salsalel over here and says go over it and over it. By over it, it doesn't mean memorize, it means review. Review means that you attach, that you go over it as if it's the first time. You go over every step. The mind is working. Memorization, the mind is not working. Review, the mind is working. You got to be very careful to distinguish between the two. And review, no matter how many times you review it, you will gain. There's a Gemara, I think it's a Pirkei Avos, says there's no difference between 100 and 101 times. And the Purushim say, the commentaries say, that it doesn't mean 100 and 101. It just mentions that, but it could be 300 and 301 times, too. You understand? There's a difference. There is a difference. I'm sorry, there is a difference between 100, 100 and 101. There's a difference between 300 and 301. You understand? So the thing is, that review, there's always a gain. It's part of the development of the mind that you review it. But memorization, there's not much of a gain. Okay? And then you should honor it, I think, means how much energy. Again, we're going back to the energy, how much energy you honor it. The result will be verse 9, that will give, if you had a garland of grace. Grace means that people will be drawn to you. The result of the creative person, the thinker, people are somehow drawn to the creative thinker. Okay? And two is to be a crown of beauty for your protection. Comes to Neko, comes from Magain, to protect you. Okay? So it will also be a beautiful crown that is your shield. You understand? That will be your shield. Okay? So therefore, people will recognize and will protect you and guard you. These are the results, which, I mean, that we've seen many places in Mishlei. But, in other words, the knowledge itself, because when you get into a situation and you're in trouble, so your mind will help you work out how to deal with it. So therefore, it will protect you. And somehow people are drawn to a Chacham. One of the things, there are a few reasons why people are drawn to a Chacham. One is that he lowered his negative emotions, which people don't sense, so they're drawn. And two, come to conclusions that are different of people around him. So therefore, people are drawn to him because of the rebellion. Because in their mind, in his mind, he's just following his mind. But however, when people look at what he's saying, it sounds like rebellion. So they attach to him because of rebellion. So therefore, they're drawn to him because to them it sounds like rebellion. Just another idea why people are drawn to him. It is true. If it's for this emotion itself, a lot of people that are against rebellion would turn against him. But the thing is the reason is a possibility that they don't all. Why? Because since they know he's in line with reality, he's accepted as a Chacham. So therefore, that's the license to have rebellion. Most people have rebellion. But however, their desire to be part of society is stronger than their rebellion. So therefore, here the guy is accepted as a Chacham. People recognize him as a wise person, even though he comes to conclusions that are totally different than anybody thought. You understand? So therefore, in that way, it's a license. You're right. Not everybody will be able to attach to him for that. You understand? But I'm just saying more people could attach to them because of their rebellion, have an outlet because of that. Okay? Okay? They were up to Pasuk Yud, Pasuk 10. It says, listen, my son, and take my words, and it'll add to you years of life. But what it means is, the Mitzvot David says that it means that'll add, you'll have a good life. You know what I mean? Like, it's a good life. It's not only the amount of years, but it's a good life. Okay? So when we get to the end of the 10 psukim that we're doing here, so it should tell us how we can have a good life. Okay? What we need for a good life. Verse 11 says, in the path of wisdom I have guided you, and I also guided you in the ways of Yosha. Yosha is straight. In other words, we always talk about a criminal as crooked. He looks at life, or he either looks at life or acts in a crooked way, not according to the correct path, the straight path of truth. But we go the straight path of truth. So the type of wisdom, in other words, verse 11 is saying that the path of wisdom that I'm going to guide you on now is to get to think straight and correct. Okay? The opposite of the criminal. Okay? So here again, we'll have to see how it works at the end of the 10th sukkah. 12. When you walk, you will not be, Yetzer is pushed in, squeezed in your walk. In other words, you ever try to walk on the curve and you walk one foot in front of the other, like you're not spread out? So it's very hard to walk. You have to keep your balance. So the thing is that you'll never be, when you walk, you'll never be pushed in that way. You'll have plenty of room to move. And if you run, you won't trip. In other words, if you follow my ways, you listen to this parak, so then all your actions will be successful. You'll be a successful person. In all your actions, you'll be able to operate securely. You'll be able to walk securely. You'll be able to run and you won't fall. You'll be in a secure manner. 13. Says, grab on or hold on to Musar. In other words, the Musar that he's going to tell you. Don't let it go. And guard it because this is your life. Okay? So he says, you should really go over it and make it your personality and go over it again and again. Now we start coming to the point in which he wants to guide us. He says, the ways of the wicked don't come. Now most people translate Tasha and don't go in the path of the evil people. Okay? But the word to Asher could mean like something good, like Asherei, like it's something good, like you praise this life, that it's a good life. It says don't praise it. In other words, you shouldn't praise it. Now, okay, we'll soon see why. The next verse, Pasuk 15, go back to everything I've said, or what I've just said. In other words, about the don't go in the ways of the wicked, and don't praise them, and don't pass this up. Don't let the tavor, don't go over it. Don't pass it. This idea, what I'm saying, is a very strong, important point. Don't pass it. And seteme olav avor, and pass by them, and just turn away from them and pass by them. Don't have anything to do with the wicked. Okay? Now, the thing is, when it says don't have anything to do with the wicked, then the thing is that, that's very nice, tells me not to do with the wicked, but I want to see from my own wisdom, from my own mind, why I shouldn't have anything to do with the wicked. So he says, key because. He says, they can't sleep if they don't do evil. And their sleep is stolen from them. Their sleep is taken away from them. They don't cause somebody else to fail. The question is, what does he mean? So the person can't sleep. But what does it mean? What causes a person not to be able to sleep? So the reason why you can't sleep is because you're addicted to this thing and you must do it. It's like, let's say, for instance, a person that smokes. And he didn't smoke. Let's say he didn't smoke. It's hard for him to sleep. He must have that cigarette. Or some people, they can't sleep if they don't have something to eat. You understand? When you're addicted and drawn to the thing, in other words, let's say, for instance, like when you go to sleep, sometimes if you feel comfortable, like you ate, so you feel comfortable, you could sleep. But that doesn't mean you can't sleep if you're hungry. you should be able to sleep if you're hungry. You understand? But if I can't sleep because I'm hungry, that means I have an addiction. What he's saying, these people are so addicted, so drawn to evil, that if they didn't have an outlet for their evil act, you understand? If they don't do that evil thing, then they can't operate. They just can't operate. You see, they can't sleep. They can't sleep. It takes away their sleep. They're constantly driven. You know what I mean? Like somebody told me, he says, about his father. He says his father was very wealthy. And he says that sometimes his father tells him, he says he wakes up in the middle of the night and his mind jumps to business and this problem and that problem. He says he can't go back to sleep. He can wake up 1, 2 o'clock in the morning and that's it. He can't go back to sleep. You see? Person is driven. Then if you haven't completed the act, then you can't sleep. If you're attached to the act that you must do it or you must complete it, depending what the addiction is, if you don't have it, then you can't sleep. He's talking about these people are so evil that if they didn't do an evil act that day, then they can't sleep. Hey, the question is the same thing work with ideas and the life of justice? The answer is that we said in the third parak, we said that a person that's guided by wisdom will know what he could do and what he can't do. So when he can't do it, he'll just say, look, I can't do it, and he'll go to sleep. You understand? As long as he feels he could do something, that'll keep him awake. In other words, learning, I hold, is an addiction, like you're driven to it. But the fact is, you're driven from a different source than the other. In other words, the emotions go, in other words, the energy goes through reality. So therefore, even though you're driven, it drives you via reality. The other one is you're driven, but you're driven via your fantasies and all these emotions that make you see life incorrectly. So that is the first reason why you should not walk in the ways of the evil. Not even come close to them. Stay away from them. Okay? Because it's a terrible life. It shows, in other words, this is just shows you the conflict that they have. The conflict is so strong that they can't sleep. You understand? When the conflict is strong, your fears, your desires are so powerful, those are the things that keep you awake. You see what I mean? Okay. So we're talking about evil. Okay. Now he explains why. He says, key because, why can't they sleep? Because their bread is the bread of evil, and their wine, the wine that they drink is the wine of violence. Okay, that's what drives them, is that wine. Okay, now the question is, I mean, that's definitely a metaphor. You understand? It can't be literal. It's a metaphor, right? So the question is, what is the metaphor saying? Let me ask a different question. What's the difference between bread and wine? There are two things that a person lives by. The practical, what his needs are, and two, the pleasure. For him, for the evil person, his need and his pleasure, what drives him, and what his needs are, and what he enjoys, is one and the same thing. His total being, his total essence, is just pure evil. In other words, that's all that drives him. There's nothing else. That's his practicality. That's his practical life. Practically, he lives by violence, and he can't live without it, and he enjoys it. In other words, I'll give you an example. Let's say, for instance, a person is addicted to smoking. So there's a need to smoke, but there's also an enjoyment in smoking. But he can't stop it. He's driven by it because it's a need. It's like bread. Like, you have to have bread. You can't live without bread. You can't live without a meal. You must have the meal. But it's also his enjoyment. Hey, the question is, why does he choose this particular thing? Let's say some people live other type of lives that they're totally driven, and we see a lot of people that are driven, and it's not only the totally evil person that is driven. Okay? Next question. Hey, the Torah speaks to, there are three types of people. There's the tzaddik, there's the rasha, and there's mediocrity. The Torah only talks about two, about the tzaddik and the rasha. Doesn't talk about mediocrity, because mediocrity really doesn't have free will. What is mediocrity? Mediocrity is I have a certain type of personality, and I can't get out of that personality. The rasha, the tzaddik and the rasha, are people that get out of their personality, make a decision to go beyond their personality. You understand? Nobody is born evil. Nobody is born righteous. There's a certain, you might have certain tendencies, but the thing is there's a certain development. You understand? It takes a certain amount of time that you keep getting worse and worse and worse. If you're going towards evil, and you keep getting better and better as you go towards righteousness. In fact, that's going to be the next pasuk. You see, the next pasuk had that in the consideration. In other words, it could be the next pasuk. I didn't realize. Could be the next pasuk really had in mind that question, because it says the way of the righteous is like the shining light. In other words, the shining sun, which continuously gets lighter until midday. Okay? Until midday. It's constantly going in that direction. While the way of the wicked is like darkness, he doesn't know what will trip him up. Okay? Right. Let's just take the thing that the tzaddik is constantly going in a certain direction. The wicked are going in the opposite direction. Mediocrity doesn't go in any direction. It just stays where it is. Okay? But you'll notice that it doesn't talk about evil, that evil keeps going in a certain direction. It says the way of the wicked is like darkness. He doesn't know what will trip him up. We will see that will also fit into mediocrity. Okay? In other words, if a person is either mediocrity or evil, insofar as righteousness is concerned, you have to move in a certain direction. But the results, many times the results of mediocrity or we'll soon see that they're both the same in a certain way. Okay? The question is what's the difference between mediocrity and doing what the Rishayim do, doing what the wicked do? Okay? The mediocrity is, let's say, for instance, I have a desire to punch you out, but I feel too guilty, I can't. The wicked person will force himself to punch. He'll feel guilty, but he'll go against his guilt until he doesn't feel bad about it. There was a man by G. Gordon Liddy was the guy that broke into the Watergate, and he wrote an autobiography. So he says when he was a young boy, he was a mama's boy. He was really afraid, so he says to force himself to stop being a mama's boy, he took rats and ate them or killed them alive. Like he did crazy things. He forced himself that he's not going to be a mama's boy, you see? Now, the thing is that he really was a tough guy. He became a really tough guy. But then when he was put in prison for Watergate, so he felt the old emotion of the mama's boy come back. So he says he took a cigarette and lit it and then started burning himself to make himself tough again. You see what I mean? So you see, here's a guy that has the feeling of a mama's boy, but he drives himself to go in the opposite direction. You understand that nothing should stop him. Now, if he could have become real evil, it just so happens he went far, but he didn't become really evil, you know what I mean? But the thing is that you see that that's the type of person that's going outside of his personality, beyond his personality, what he naturally would do, but there's another part of him says, no, I'm not going to let this happen. I'm going to force myself. Then if that happens, then step by step, you don't know how far he could go, where he could go. The question is not all wickedness is violence. Okay? That is the question. The answer is there's two types of extremes in wickedness. There's the life of pleasure and the life of wickedness. That's the only two. Is there anything else? There are only two pleasures, in other words, where a person could make a decision to go beyond his personality. He's going to go in one of two areas, either the life of pleasure or the life of wickedness. Is there any other possibility? Once again, verse 17. We're saying that it has to be a metaphor because bread is not the bread of evil. You understand? That doesn't have any meaning. So we're saying that bread means practicality, and wine, when it means the wine of violence, it means pleasure. Now, when somebody is addicted to something, practically his life revolves around that addiction. He can't get away from it. That's practical. But it's also his pleasures. In other words, let's say I have jealousy. I'm driven to jealousy. So I go buy a house that I can't afford just because I'm jealous of you. But I also enjoy it until the bills start coming in anyway. You understand? But the fact is there's a certain enjoyment. And addiction means that I have both. I'm driven by it. I can't live without it. And it's like, I can't live without it. That's like bread. And insofar as wine is concerned, so it's my pleasure. It's the thing which I enjoy too. Yeah, when we say practicality, we don't mean practicality like eating bread. But to you, because you, what is practicality? You can't live without practical in this world. If you don't look both ways when you cross the street, you won't make it. You have to breathe. You have to eat. You understand? These are practical things. You have to go to a doctor when you're sick. These are practical things. To him, he can't live without this. He can't live. That's his practicality. He can't live. He spends his life buying drugs. He sells his money. He sells his life down the river for anything. They're so important. He can't live without it. And simultaneously, it's his pleasure. A clarification on a need and a pleasure, okay? The need over here is, I'm defining need as I can't live without it. But it's also something, in fact, when you start smoking, there's a certain enjoyment in it before you become addicted. Then you become addicted. You still enjoy the smoke. You still enjoy the smoke. So there's an addiction that it's a need, and it is a pleasure, both together. Okay? In other words, we're saying about the wicked person that he can't sleep and that this is his personality. In other words, a person that starts out has a certain conflict, you see? But then what happens is he reaches a level of evil where there is no conflict. In other words, the first step, he moves out of his personality. But then later on, he has conflict. You understand? But there's a certain point where he starts doing evil, where he will not have any conflict, and he's actually driven to do it. That's the insecurity of taking a move. You know, people feel secure. Well, I won't change. I can hang around evil people. And I won't change, you know what I mean? I know my personnel, I know I am. You can't be secure. You can't be secure. You can't hang around them. It just draws you in because you have the emotion. The only one that can hang around them is a person that's a tzaddik that reached a level where he has no conflict about his righteousness. You understand? He has undone all conflicts about his righteousness. I mean, that's the only person that won't be affected. But even Noach was going to be affected, and therefore God had to educate the public, had to set him up in a different way. He didn't go to the public, but the public came to him. Avram, the public came to him. I mean, by Avram, Avram went to the public. He was able to visit with them. It didn't affect him. But Noach, if he would have gone into their milieu, then he would have been affected. So he had to set up that he built a ark. So people knew he was an intelligent person, so they'd come and ask him, what are you doing? So he'd tell them about the prophecy, but they had to come to him. That was the thing with Noah. And here's a guy, a prophet, but he had the conflict. He couldn't undo his conflict. Not everybody could become a tzaddik to undo their conflict. Now the question is, how does a mediocrity become a tzaddik? Okay? How does he move out of his realm? Okay? And the first thing is he sits down and he learns Gemara and Halacha, and he learns Musa. But however, when he learns it, it's in his, he puts it in his emotional framework. In other words, let's say I'm a religious person, so I put it in my religious emotion. If I'm a competitive person, so I put it in my competitive, in other words, I compete in these areas, and I put it in my competitive thing. It's in the framework of my personality, you see? Now, there's a certain point where the ideas of Musa become so real to you that you make a move out, or you start doing it, not because of your personality, that it fits into your personality, but you do it because of reality. In other words, you'll start doing things that before you couldn't do. In other words, there's a certain point that within your personality, there's certain things you just can't do. And reality dictates that you should do these things. And you're going to have to force yourself to go against your personality. And when you go against your personality, if it doesn't change just by the reality, so then you're going to have to investigate your emotions until you change. Same thing with halacha. There's certain halachas that are totally against your personality. It just bothers you when you do it. You might force yourself, but it bothers you. At a certain point, you're going to have to start changing. Either the living the life of truth and seeing the reality behind it will help change you. If that's not enough to change you, then you must investigate the emotion. The investigation emotion will free it and free the emotion, and then you start making decisions based on reality. But before you make that move out, you make decisions on reality. You might make decisions on reality, but it's still in the framework of your personality. You understand? That is the move, the first step that the tzaddik, or the chacham makes. First your chacham. The first stage that the chacham makes out of his personality. And both the tzaddik and the rasha, when they first make that move out, there's always conflict. It has to be terrible conflict. You're going against power. The unconscious is a very, very powerful place. And that's why, I mean, they both must have the courage to make a move out of their personality, to go beyond. There's a certain amount of courage that both must have. You understand? To go beyond it and to live in conflict, to continue doing what's right, but to live in conflict, or to do what's wrong and to live in conflict. And until you either continue just living in conflict or you undo it, one of the two. Okay? That's the two ways of the tzaddik and the rasha. That's why the Torah always talks about the tzaddik and the rasha. You understand? Because those are the people that are making a move. And those are the people we have to talk to. In other words, to tell them which direction to go and why they shouldn't go in the direction of evil. Okay? Before we review the whole chapter, to clarify the whole chapter, we took a lot of different points. I just want to clarify verse 19. Up to verse 19, I think we clarified everything. 18 tells about the righteous that he constantly moving towards light until he reaches midday with the brightest point. Okay, I don't know if everybody reaches that, but that's the direction. He's going towards clarity and ideas and light. Okay? Now, what's the way of the wicked? The way of the wicked is like darkness. He doesn't know what makes him trip. Okay? First of all, there's a translation means stumble. They translate Yikoshlu as stumble. That's the wrong translation. Because stumble means I fall, but I catch myself. I didn't fall down, stumble. Trip means I fall. We're talking about falling. Yikoshlu means you fail, you trip, you fall down. Stumble is the beginning of tripping, maybe. You understand? We're talking about tripping. You fall down. It's a destruction. Now, the thing is, the best way to explain this pasuk is by telling you a metaphor that the author of Duties of the Heart, the Chovos HaLevavos, Bachi Ibn Bakuda, wrote. He says, if you come into a room that is totally dark and you try to walk around, you will trip over the furniture. But if you put on a small light, a small pinpoint flashlight, let's say, you can just see enough in front of you, then you'll see where there are obstacles and walk away and not walk into these obstacles. Okay? The metaphor is the light of truth. In other words, like we said many times, that hashkafa is a viewpoint. So you learn to look at any situation from all different viewpoints, so you'll see all the different angles, so you'll know where things will trip you up and where you fail, and where and how to avoid it, how to avoid these stumbling blocks, you see? But if you don't, suddenly you bang into something. It's a sudden thing. In fact, I think it was Rashi that says when it's like darkness, it's sudden. It's like sudden. Why is it sudden? Because there is nothing telling you that there's anything there. Suddenly you bang into it, just like you're walking in that dark room. You suddenly bang into it as if it's something out of the blue. It's not out of the blue. It was always there. It was coming. You were moving in that direction the whole time, but you weren't aware of it. It's like walking around in darkness, okay? So now, okay, is that clear? So therefore, I think we have all the particular verses, okay? Now the thing is let's summarize everything we have, okay? And let's start with the last verses. The thing is, there are two qualities of what you must reach in your relationship to the wicked. You must first step not be jealous of them, because you see that it's a terrible life. And two, must reach a level where it annoys you. Okay? It bothers you. Now you have to be careful here. It's not that it bothers you because of some guilt, but it bothers you because of reality. Sometimes things bother people because they really desire to do it, but they feel guilty they can't do it. So then they talk about people that are evil. You understand? We're not talking about that person. We're talking about a person that is turned off and bothers him. Like Elisha, when he came in the presence of evil, he couldn't get prophecy because he was so angry, and you can't get prophecy when you're angry or in a bad mood. Okay? So the thing is, now, what will get you there, that's what King Solomon is telling us here. What will get you is you must think through these ideas. One is that these people they're driven. They have so many conflicts. They can't sleep. They say Hitler used to spend the whole night talking with his friends at the top echelon, just patting himself on the job. We weren't talking about business. They just talked about how great they are until it got light, then they could go to sleep. They couldn't sleep. This is the most powerful man in the country, and he can't sleep at night. Usually you can think a frightened person, somebody's going to break into my house, so you can't sleep. That's who you think can't sleep. But Hitler, the most powerful guy in the world at the time, he couldn't sleep. Because of all his conflicts, he can't sleep. You will not get any relaxation. There is no, in the life of evil, there's absolutely no relaxation. You cannot relax. If you're in the mafia, you're always worried about who's going to kill you. Your best friend, You have to worry about your best friend. You can't sleep. And the question is that we said that a wicked person doesn't have conflict. We're saying that he reaches a point of inner conflict that he doesn't have, but he still has conflict with reality, and that conflict is a powerful conflict. Okay? It's a powerful conflict. Okay? All right, and then the next thing is that the next thing shows that, in other words, the two verses, verse 16 and 17, show the nature of the conflict, and the in other words, the conflict is that he's driven, and it's his enjoyment, it's every aspect of his life. He eats and drinks evil. He's driven to, and the very evil causes him not to sleep and not to be able to enjoy life and not to be able to relax. The very evil causes him to take everything away from him, but he cannot stop himself. That you must see clearly to know not to take that step towards evil and to be frightened of every area to not do that. That will cause you not to get close to these people, what he advised you before. Don't go near them. Pass them by. Get out of the way. Stay away from them. That's one idea that you have to see. That's the inner... These two psukim are showing the inner conflict. Okay? Now, he says that the tzaddik is constantly going towards light. You must realize that when you start out, you have a little, very little light. You understand? You might have conflict. But he's telling you, you must be aware that the tzaddik is going in a certain direction of pure light. He's going towards, away from his conflicts, and towards the world of truth and reality. You understand? It's the direction which he is going. The very direction in which he's going makes it a different light, even though he has conflict. But there is, it's a different direction. You see? You must have that in mind, because many times I say, well, what's the difference between me and the time of being in Russia? He's in conflict and I'm in conflict, so what's the big deal? I might as well go out and enjoy life. The answer is it's a different lifestyle, even the direction in which you're going. It's already, you're in conflict, but the direction in which you're going is a totally different direction. And it's, in other words, you can only, if you go in the way of the, you have conflict and you go in the way of the Russia, the conflicts get worse. Here you're going in a direction where the conflicts get better. You understand? You start slowly and do that. You're going in a different direction. It makes life better. And because you're guided by Chachma, it avoids new conflicts and new things that, like the furniture that you bang into because you don't see, the things that will you'll see and you won't be hurt. You see? So you must make the comparison that keep you going. You must make the comparison when you are not the tzaddik yet, where you're first starting out, like in the book of Mishlei, so you must constantly make the comparison. Okay? And there's one more thing that you must think of, and you must see how the Russia doesn't see where he's going. He's really a blind man. That he's walking into furniture, he's banging all over himself, and that with knowledge, you see how you avoid these conflicts. You must make that comparison to see where these ideas help you think through to avoid conflict, to avoid problems in the physical. In other words, there's two things. There's the inner being, the nature of the person, and two, the physical world. So the first part is talking about the nature and the conflict that you can't sleep. That shows the conflict, you see? While the second part, the darkness, shows the physical world, that they'll make mistakes and bang into the physical world. And you have to see that the tzaddik is just the opposite, that he's moving away from conflict and he's avoiding problems in the physical world. You see what I mean? And when you see clearly the two lifestyles, then you go back to the beginning of this parak and you'll see what you'll have. The first thing is you'll have a good life. Why? Because you won't have the conflicts, and you won't have the consequences of banging into things that you didn't notice, okay? It'll give you clarity, it'll make you straight, because you'll avoid all evil, and you'll try to live the life of reality and truth and justice. So that's the straight life, the straight and narrow path, right? You'll be free, because you'll be able to run because you know what you're doing. You're not afraid of banging into things, and you're not going to be pushed over because you're skating like on thin ice. So you'll be totally secure when you do your things. But to do this, you must hold on to Mussar. You must guard it. You can't let go of it. And never, ever allow yourself to come in the way of the wicked. Don't even give it an inch, because it has a way of sneaking in. Don't even take one step. It has a way of sneaking in and taking everything away. In other words, the result of seeing these ideas should be that two things. It'll take away your jealousy of evil, and it'll turn you off when you come in the presence of evil. You see how stupid it is and how harmful it is to that person and to people around him. It's his own family he's destroying because of all his blindness and his conflicts and his lifestyle. Again and again and again. You would see it again and again. Just look around you. And you must see it again and again to affect the emotions. You must constantly see it again and again and again to affect the emotions. That's the good thing about reading biographies or autobiographies of evil people. You understand their conflicts and their lifestyles and their decisions, their stupid decisions, and then compare to the life of the tzaddik. You understand? That's very important. Those stories will affect you in that direction, to go in that direction, in the way of to really look down on the evil person. Like you can't tolerate it; it bothers you. In other words, you can't separate and say one of me is moving in one way and one is moving in the other. What happens is you're moving in a certain direction, but you still have baggage from the other direction. In other words, if you're moving towards evil, you still have your baggage of your conscience bothers you. You understand? If you're moving towards the way of Torah, then all your pleasures and all your desires that you would love to do, you're in conflict with. And sometimes you even have to give into it a little bit, as long as it's not against the law and it's not destructive. You should give into these pleasures because you need an outlet, as you need it to be able to continue going. If you control yourself totally, you could really harm yourself. You understand? So it has to be with a cheshbon, knowing who and what you are, but you're constantly moving in a certain direction, and as you move in that direction, you're able to give up more. It can't be an overnight thing. It's a lifetime process. And as you're able to give up of the different physical things, to be able to enjoy the life of chachma and wisdom, so then it's a slow process. In other words, you're moving towards light. You're constantly moving towards light. Very few people reach midday. It's totally pure light. You understand? That's a rarity. Okay, the question is, we're talking about a person that makes a decision. In other words, we're talking about a person that has... that his emotions are in line with the ideas. So that shows that these emotions are a good thing. It's good. On the other hand, we see from Elisha, he was angry when he came into the presence of evil, and yet he couldn't get prophecy. He had to calm down before he could get prophecy. So that seems to point that it's not a good thing. Okay? So the question is it good or bad? It seems to be both. The answer is like this. Since the nature of the human being is that he has emotions, he can't get rid of emotions. So you must live with emotions. The only thing is we say that emotions, if you have emotions, they should be in line with the world of ideas. So when your emotions are in line with the world of ideas, so then the emotion is a barometer of who you are. Then it's a barometer of who you are. Okay? But however, the Meiri in the beginning of Pirkei Avos says that a person should not make a decision based on any type of emotion, even these emotions. He should always make decisions based on logic, and even when he's in the throes of the emotion that's in line with reality, he should make a decision. You understand? So even though it's a barometer of the right thing and it's a good thing, but at that time he should not make a decision, right? Now, prophecy is a life of learning and a life of ideas, and even Moshe had to make a decision whether to accept the prophecy or not to accept the prophecy. By the burning bush, he made a decision not to accept the prophecy. You understand? So therefore, you must always, when you're getting prophecy, you have to be ready to make a decision. If you're in the throes of the emotion, then you might make a decision based on that emotion. So it's not fitting for you to get prophecy during that time. But still in all, the emotion in and of itself is a barometer for telling me what your nature is, who and what you are. So it shows me who you are, that you are on a level that your emotions are in line. And since you can't get rid of emotions, so therefore, but you can't get prophecy when these emotions are awakened. In other words, that's correct. The way of putting it is that really it's a good thing because it shows who you are, but practically, it's a practical thing. It's a practical thing that you can't get prophecy during that state. Yeah, like the examples, let's say you're hungry. So sometimes you can't learn because you're hungry, so it's a practical thing. So you go eat, then you're able to learn. So sometimes there's certain things because of the human being, so the human condition, that he has to take care of the practicality. Okay? So therefore, because of practicality, you can't get nevuah. But however, it's a good thing because it shows who the person is.
Verse 20. And basically, we're going to go straight with the Rashi and the Ibn Ezra. Okay? It's basically their interpretation. Okay. Right, so it says, B'ni, my son, listen to my words and to my... what I say, turn your ears. In other words, just repeating that, in other words, like an introduction that this is very important. Okay? Verse 21. Don't turn away from it. Don't let your eyes turn away from it. Guard them within your heart. In other words, make it second nature. Because they are the life for all that find them, and for all your flesh it will heal. In other words, it's the basis of all life. For success in life, you can't live without this. Then he says, Mikol Mishma, of everything you guard, the most important thing is you should guard your heart. The heart over here means the mind. Okay? You should guard your mind. Okay? Because from it goes out all life. In other words, the way you think, the way you think, that's all the decisions are going to come from. So all the decisions come from the mind. That's the essence of the mind. So that's the most important thing to guard. Okay? And he didn't come to tell you how yet. Okay? Now he says, Hoss, turn from you all crooked mouths and distortions of the lips, distance from you. According to Rashi and the Ibn Ezra, they say that you should make sure nobody talks bad about you. That's basically what they're saying. That's what this verse is saying. In other words, whatever it is in the mind that we're talking about, you'll avoid people talking about you. Okay? Then again, it says, verse 25, your eyes should be straight, should look straight, and your eyelids should be straight in front of you. In other words, you should always be, in other words, what we're talking about here, one of the Mefarshim, I don't think it was Rashi or the Ibn Ezra, they say it's a metaphor like for the, I think it was the Meiri. He says it's for the eyes of the mind. In other words, you must keep your mind straight. Okay? Now, 26 is the essence of the whole chapter. That one thing. According to Rashi and the Ibn Ezra, okay? Because the others learn it differently. He says, Pales way, magal raglecha, the path of your feet, and all your ways will be firm. So the essence of this verse is way, the path of your feet. What does he mean by way, the path of your feet? In other words, if you have this quality, then you'll have the... in other words, if you have this quality, then the result will be, or maybe a barometer will be, that nobody will talk badly about you. Nobody will look at you in a bad way. With the wisdom and with creativity, you learn also, you have to learn how to think in terms, especially in the creative part, you have to think in different possibilities, okay? You have to think about different possibilities in any given situation. The next step after that, after you learn, you're creative. And so if you're working, it'll always come out practically at all times. There always comes out a few possibilities, at least two. And then you have to weigh the two possibilities. It's the weighing, the measuring of which is the right one. Sometimes you have, when let's say, for instance, in an action, so you weigh all the factors, how you should act in a certain situation, and many times there are different factors based on different things, how you make decisions, and it comes out that you could either act this way or that way, and it comes down to the mind weighing the two possibilities, evaluating the two possibilities. Okay? Rashi says by Pelas, that weigh the path of your feet. He says, weigh your ways, measure your ways, the loss of not doing a positive thing, a good thing, versus the reward, okay, of for doing a sin. In other words, doing the wrong thing. Weigh the positive of doing the correct thing and avoiding the bad thing versus the loss of what will happen if you do the bad thing. Okay? That is the essence of all decisions that you have to make. There's two steps. One is, many times there are two possibilities, you don't know which is the right one. So first you have to weigh that. You have to weigh both. What is the result? What are the consequences? What is the right thing? What is all the ideas, the way you think about? And two, then your mind must see the benefit of doing the right in this area and in this particular area again and again, to see what is right, of the benefit of doing the right way and the harm of doing the wrong way. That is the essence. If you act that way, then if you're constantly evaluating, that is, I think we said this about Das, in Proverbs we said Das, that's the essence of decision making. The essence of decision making is constantly measuring. Either you're measuring two possibilities, which is the right and which is the wrong, or you're measuring what's the benefit of doing the right and what is the harm of doing the wrong. And a lot of this is dependent on like a certain intuition. Sometimes you have proofs with this, then it's very easy. But the difficulty is many times which is right and which is wrong. And what's wrong is that many times you have to work it out. After you have creativity, then you can start thinking in this way. You understand? I mean, you could start now, too, because you start evaluating things. You can always start. But the thing is that is the essence of decision-making. That's what it's talking about here. One side point. We were talking about the subject of Mussar. What are the different components or parts of Musa? Okay? One is consequences. You must evaluate anything that you're going to do and evaluate the consequences. That's one subject. Right? Two is what causes you to do the incorrect view is your emotions. So the next thing you have to study is psychology, okay? The third thing is strategy or a plan, Like, for instance, if you want to do an action, there has to be a plan. First, you have to have the goal, and then have the steps to get there. What is the best way of getting there? You want to fight with your yetzirah, the emotions, and deal with it. So then you have to have a plan. How you do it? There's different ways. What are your needs? You have to evaluate your needs and how you should do it. So that takes care of three, right? There is a fourth one, and that is logic. But logic is like in two parts. One is where you have a subject and you train yourself through the subject to think correctly. And after your teacher has taught you ideas and concepts, and you're familiar and understand the concepts, to straighten the mind out, there is a benefit in learning the subject of logic itself. So therefore, that is the four subjects of, in other words, the training of the mind, which is two parts. So those are the four subjects of Musa. In other words, consequences, psychology, planning or strategy, and logic itself, thinking itself. Those are the four subjects of Musa. It's good to know this so that when you come across at any place in Torah, sometimes like Chumash doesn't have, it goes through all the different subjects. Musa has God. So at least when you come to a pasuk or a Rashi or a commentary, so then you're able to recognize at least what area you're dealing with. Okay? Right. It makes it easier. The question, side question that was asked like this. Let's say, for instance, there's a difference of opinion in halacha. Okay? So one rabbi make the paskins or makes a decision one way, another rabbi makes the paskins, makes a decision another way. So the thing is that both are right. In fact, it says in the Gemara, Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim. Both are the words of the living God. Okay? In other words, both are the words of the living God. The question is, how is that possible? God only said one. And if you live according to the one that God didn't say, so then you're not keeping God's system. How is that possible? Okay? That is the question that was asked. Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, in his introduction to logic, brings a medrash. The medrash says that a Roman captain asked Rabbi Akiva, which is better, God-made things or man-made things? So Rabbi Akiva showed him wheat and he showed him bread. He says, which is better? Definitely man-made things are better, right? I mean, because you can't eat the wheat. And then he goes on, he says, if you look at the world, there's very few things, like for instance, fruit grows wild. Says there's no comparison between the fruit that grows wild and that's cultivated by man, where he takes care of it and makes it grow. They make it grow bigger and quantity more and bigger and qualitatively better. They work it out to all the things. So he says, you see, practically everything in the world is created incomplete, and it was given over to the human to complete it. So you see, God does, even in his creation, he created the world in such a way that he gives man responsibility. In fact, that was Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto's introduction to logic. Says even the mind might be able to think correctly, but it also make mistakes. But the human being, through training, can straighten out the mind that it should make less mistakes or make no mistakes. And the book of logic is a way of helping. Okay. You also find in human traits, we have a lot of bad habits, bad ways of thinking. You understand? Bad ways of acting, evil ways sometimes, and we're born that way. We start out that way from a very young age, and we have to straighten these things out. You say, we're given that responsibility. Given responsibility in everyday life to make decisions. Okay? There was one other thing that God gave us responsibility for, and that was for the halachic system. He gave us responsibility to take care of it as humans, you see? And therefore, since we are human, and since that we could make mistakes, or we might forget what God actually said, and there's two logical possibilities, so when it comes out to two logical possibilities, you can't do wrong if you do either one of them. You understand? But that's because, that's only because that God gave the, God gave responsibility to the human being. You see, there's many areas that God gave responsibility. You see, like you see in creation, the very creation, you see that God has given, the way he created it, according to Ramash Chaim Zotzata, you see, that he very created it so that the human being should have responsibility in completing it. We have cars, we go to the moon, all these things is because we completed things in nature. We used the facts of nature to create new things in nature. You see? And the same thing in our person, in who we are, in our health, in all everything, in our very being. We're not complete. We have to take care of ourselves. We have to take responsibility for it. You see? And the same thing with halacha. The halachic system was given over to the human to maintain and to take care of. We're going to do a Proverbs chapter 15, verse 18. It says, a man of anger causes quarrels. And he who takes long to anger, he doesn't get angry right away, quiets quarrels. Okay? So, and the first question is, what does it mean it takes long to anger? That's the first question. Okay, the question is that if you are long to anger, it takes time for you to get angry, that should be, it should say that it doesn't, he avoids anger, he avoids a quarrel, or it doesn't make the quarrel bigger, but it says it quiets the quarrel itself. Okay? Somehow it quiets the quarrel itself. So the question is, how does it quiet the quarrel? Rashi says he's not in a rush to take, when it says it's long to anger, Rashi says he's not in a rush to take vengeance and to quarrel, which seems to be that sometimes you should get into a quarrel. He takes his time to think about it. In other words, he makes, there's two levels. Either you really don't get angry, or you do get angry, but you control it. You understand? But Rashi talks about the result, that he doesn't go to take vengeance right away. When you scream at him, he doesn't take vengeance right away. So if he doesn't take vengeance right away, which means that sometimes he should, okay? In other words, it's thought out. Because if you should never take vengeance, then Rashi is there. It shouldn't be Erech HaPaim, it should be he never gets angry. Sometimes you should get angry, okay? It's correct to get angry. There's certain situations where it's correct to get angry. According to the Meiri, Erech HaPaim means I have the anger all along, and I just control it. I control the anger in waiting for the fight to... in other words, my purpose is to wait for the argument to end. That would be the second if that it quiets the quarrel. But we don't know how that works or in what situations it worked. That was our question. Right, but those are the two ways of looking at Erech HaPaim, that controlling your anger or long to anger. Okay, everybody wants to say that what it means is like this. If you do not answer right away, okay, for whatever reason, whether the Rashi's reason or the Miri's reason, but whatever reason that you do not answer right away, they say it's very hard to maintain anger if there's not return anger.
In other words, if the other person is totally quiet, it talks to him, doesn't say talk to him in an appeasing way, Doug, that you were adding to the verse. It just says you just don't answer him, you understand? You just don't answer the guy, so that will quiet him down, all right? Now, the question is, why is that fact true? The verse says, long to anger. So we're discussing whether that means that he doesn't, whether he doesn't say anything. The question is whether he doesn't say anything, or he just starts the conversation as if the guy is not angry and just talks to the words of the anger, but doesn't talk in an angry voice. Like he's having a regular conversation, like when you scream, when somebody screams at you, so you listen to what he says, and you talk back to him, only to what he says, and you try to say, well, what's the problem? Could you please, in other words, you're angry about this and this. Now, what can we do about it? Or something, like you talk to the thing, but you don't get angry. Right? So, now, according to the Meiri says definitely that he does not answer, because according to the Meiri, he himself is angry, so he can't talk, because if he talks, the anger will show up. So in other words, if you are angry, then it absolutely means quiet. According to Rashi, where it's talking about an action, where he doesn't rush to take vengeance, there it could fit in with what you're saying, okay? So the question is, according to the Meiri, in other words, so I understand if you talk to him in a natural way, so then that works. And but still, well, we still want to understand why it works. The person is angry. Either way, we still know why it works. Well, in other words, I would say the truth is there's really two situations. Sometimes the situation is you can't answer to the anger. Sometimes you really shouldn't answer at all. The best thing is to be quiet. But anyway, the Meiri is definitely learning it, that he doesn't answer at all. Okay? But either way, whichever way you say, the question is somebody's really boiling, and just by not answering, taking the Meiri, the extreme case, just by not answering, that will quiet the quarrel. And everybody says they experience this type of thing. Okay? So accepting the fact is true. But what we want to understand is, how does it work? In other words, anger is dependent on a certain situation. And when the situation passes, in other words, there's an immediate situation. If the situation passes, so then there's no more anger. Okay? Correct. In other words, there is no anger when the situation passes. But here it's not saying that the situation passed. Here it says, if he's just quiet, it doesn't say that the situation passed. Okay, it is true, if you're angry over a certain situation, the situation passes, it could be that it's over with. You see? But over here, it doesn't say the situation is over. The only thing is when he screams and yells at you, and he's angry with you, all you do is say nothing. So the question is, how does that work? And the question is sometimes when a person is quiet, it's like a certain rebellion, like you don't answer back, and it can sometimes get a person even more angry, right? So the question is, how does he define the difference between which quiet it is? In other words, in the one, that's the question, okay. The question is, what causes anger? That's what you have to ask, what causes anger? Right. We want to say that anger is caused by my ego, or was, in other words, somehow you affected my ego in some way. I have a certain, ego we feel, in other words, there's a certain self-importance. I feel somehow a certain, it's beyond dignity, like there's something, I am important. And whenever you touch on to the way I define my importance, that brings about anger. I mean, people define their importance in different ways. So when you touch on to that feeling of importance,
Like, you don't have the right to say that or to do that. You understand? So then that gets me angry. Okay? Okay. So at least we could, if we look at anger in this way, so then I understand that quietness is a certain amount of submission. Like, I don't talk back to you. And in other words, see, when you scream at me and insult me, so I attack back. That's what Rashi says, vengeance. I attack back. So I am constantly pressing the self-importance. I'm breaking your self-importance. You always look at people telling each other off. They're always trying to pull each other down. In other words, they both sense without definition, like we defined it, without definition, they know how to get the other guy is hit his self-important buttons. And the more you understand human nature, the better you're able to hit the guy. You understand? And you keep the fight going because you're angry, so you want to hurt him. He's angry and he wants to hurt you. That's why Rashi uses the word vengeance. So it keeps the fight going. But if you stop the fight, so then he doesn't feel that his self-importance was touched on. In other words, like there's something wrong here, but it's not my self-importance. Somehow, it needs a little more clarity, but somehow we're avoiding, we're removing, by not arguing, we're removing the attack on self-importance. You see? That's what's happening. And so that's one question we still have to answer. And the second question we have to answer, the person that's angry, how do you distinguish between the quietness of rebellion, which again hits the self, but that in itself hits the self-importance. Who are you to rebel against me, right? And the submission that I'm not touching on your self-importance. So we still have two questions. The two questions that we have is, one is, in other words, when you're quiet, you're not only, you're showing him that somehow, you are showing him that the problem has nothing to do, you know, it's not that you don't accept him. You do accept him, and you look at it like a problem. You're just looking at it, it's a practical problem, let's deal with it, it's not a personal thing. You take responsibility, okay? So one is by not, I could understand if you talk to the guy as if there's a real problem and talk to his anger without getting him angry, then I could see he could look at it as a very practical thing. In other words, he comes in and says, you sold me the wrong thing, and then I spent, and you say, okay, I understand it's a problem, what can we do about it? So he wants to work it out, you know what I mean? Most people will see that it's not a personal thing. It wasn't out to get you. You understand? Like, the unconscious takes it as a personal thing. That was something that's not personal. They take it as a personal thing. You have to show him that it's not personal. You see? So the thing is that, according to the Meiri, what we're saying is that just not talking will do that. You see? So the question is, how is just not talking do that? And two, how does he know the difference between the quietness of rebellion, which will get him more angry, and the quietness of removal of that he's trying to put down your self-importance? You say that he's trying to hit your ego. Those are the two questions. So Doug wants to say that there is a certain sense. I mean, of course, here people could make mistakes and choose the wrong one unconsciously. You understand? But however, there's certain facial, there's a certain way, a certain even stance, the way you stand or your posture, your facial expressions show if you're just waiting, like, look, submitting, like you're not arguing back, you're not taking it personally. In other words, that's the answer to the other question. When you sit quietly and you are not reacting, you're showing that the situation is not a personal situation. So when you show him that, he picks up that it's not a personal situation, so it takes away what he thought was a personal situation, so he also changes. So he removes the personal situation. That's what it is. And the way he could tell whether it's really personal, like rebellion, or where it's not personal, is that's by what Doug said, by sign language, by body language, body posture, those things you pick up. So what the Pasuk is saying, that when you're quiet and it's in such a way because you're not taking it personally, you see, so he picks up on that. He picks up on that. That is why it quiets the argument. The question that was asked here is in other words, when we were working this out, so the thing is, people just basically stated the facts. It says that somehow, if you don't answer, so his anger goes away. And everybody experienced it, and they were satisfied with that. So the question is, most people wanted to stop at that point, and until the question was asked, still in awe, why does it work? But everybody was satisfied at that point. Okay? So the question is, you understand, the question is methodology of how do you go from, how do you know when you're finished or not? The answer is that some, like in this case, you have to be very careful that the cause is really a different subject than the result. In other words, the result is I observe certain consequences or certain results of my acts. That's what we said was one of the subjects of Musa. In other words, when I see a person is quiet, I see that helps end the argument. You understand? That's right. But however, we said that the cause of mistakes is in psychology, right? So the thing is, when we say that, when we see the result, in other words, when you're undoing somebody's anger, the interpretation must be in the cause, you see? And the cause was in psychology. You understand? So you have to know what subject you're in, and you must know what are the categories or what are the areas of the causes. You must be aware in any subject, when you're looking for causes, what are the type of causes you're looking for. You understand? So therefore, that was the mistake. You have to be aware in every subject, the causes take a certain direction. You understand? And that's the direction, you have to know that. Many times you just feel satisfied that you know the result. Well, you have knowledge, and it's clear to me I have the result. But the theory, the concept, the cause is not there yet. But you feel you have the whole picture. We're at chapter 15, verse 19. And it says, the way of the lazy man is like a thorn wall, and the path of the straight, Yosher is straight, like Salula is smooth. Okay? The question is, what is a thorn wall? By straight is the opposite of crooked, like the straight and narrow path. The opposite is crooked, where distorted lifestyle. Laura from this, from our side, asks that the two sides don't make sense. Because the first side is talking about lazy. The opposite of lazy is energetic. The second half is talking about a person that's straight, and the opposite of straight is crooked. So the two sides are not opposites. Alright, the first thing we have to deal with is that thorn wall. Okay? What is a thorn wall? So thorn wall means that it is difficult, okay? Now the question is for the lazy person, is life really difficult, or it's only difficult in his eyes? In other words, the physical world is just as difficult for the lazy person as for the energetic person. There's really no difference. The only thing is, in the lazy person's mind, in his own eyes, he sees life as difficult. He always sees problems where there really isn't problems. He creates his own problems, and therefore it becomes difficult for him to operate. That is what a thorn wall means. In other words, and Rashi says that it means in his own eyes. In his own eyes, he sees life that way. It's always a problem. The simple example is people that believe in their superstition. You know what I mean? Like their whole life is, you know what I mean? They have crazy things that they have to act out to protect themselves against all these superstitions. You understand? Well, for instance, a stingy person, I mean, life is hard because they can't spend money, because they're looking at life in an incorrect way. They're looking at money in an incorrect way. So they can't, you know what I mean? So they, in other words, all these emotions that make life difficult for you, and that's the way the lazy person looks at life, that it's like a thorn wall. And he always, in his own mind, he always sees difficulties where there really isn't difficulties. Okay? Now, if that's true, then the question is that there are a lot of people that are energetic that also look at life that way, except they work their way through all these complications that they create in their own mind. You understand? So the question is, why is that only attached to the lazy person? Really, there's a lot of people, but just the lazy person backs off from all these complications, while there are other people, like, for instance, like we mentioned, it's superstition. Superstitious person creates difficulties that don't exist, and he has to work out his life, and he acts it all out. He spends his days working out all these complications so the superstition shouldn't hurt him or protect himself from certain things in life which he created. And he lives that life. He's not lazy about it. There are people that are not lazy about it. You understand? So the question is, what's the difference? So why is this quality only for the lazy person? So we have two questions. The first is, what is the first half of the verse have to do with the second half? Because the opposite of lazy is energetic. And the second half talks about somebody who's straight. The opposite of straight is somebody that's crooked. And when we say that the lazy person looks at life that there is a wall of thorns in front of him all the time, so there are a lot of people that do that, and they work it out. They just spend their life doing stupid things, but they act out. They're not lazy about it, okay? So the question is, why does he attach that to the lazy person? All right, because of these questions, we're going to have to say that that lazy is a metaphor, okay? The quality, there is another verse that says that the lazy person says, I can't go out because there's a lion in the streets. He creates, that's the type of wall that we're talking about. He creates things that don't exist. And he says, I can't go out. My life is in danger, so I can't do anything. Like, he has crazy excuses for not doing things, okay? So that's really what stops the lazy person. But that quality of laziness, is what caused people to live a crooked or unjust life. In fact, the Ibn Ezra says, when it says lazy, it says it means evil. When I first read it, I didn't know what he's talking about. Lazy is not evil, you know what I mean?
But in this way, the Ibn Ezra is really right, that there's a certain quality of the lazy person that all evil people have. They see life in a way that that they have to overcome that part of life. Like, for instance, let's say, for instance, the jealous person can't tolerate, it says the wealthy person can't tolerate the dirty shoes of a poor person or the tattered shoes of a poor. He can't tolerate that he has anything. It's a certain emotion that he can't tolerate that a poor person has anything. He can't tolerate when anybody has anything, so that's why he's greedy. He has to take everything away. It's constantly driving him. And that's a thorn. I mean, he's looking at life in a totally ridiculous manner. The purpose of money is just practical, that we could live practically in life. But he sees money as a competition, like he has to win, he has to take it away, he can't tolerate that the other person has it. So that's his thorn wall. But he constantly drives. He's not lazy, but it's constantly these types of fantasies that people create in their own mind, these complications. Life is really not that complicated. What makes life complicated is your own emotions. When the emotions make life complicated, so then you have to live in a distorted manner, not in line with reality. And once you do that, then you start doing evil things. You start to, because people just represent another barrier in your way to what you think life should be, you see? So therefore, it's the distorted person that is really, that's what it means by distorted person. The distorted person has the same quality. In other words, if the lazy person was not lazy, if Hitler was lazy, then nothing bad would have happened. But because he was energetic, because he drove himself to overcome his demons that he himself created, you see, therefore a catastrophe happens. So the same quality that stops the lazy person, that makes the lazy person can't operate, that very quality is the quality which makes the evil person evil. And that is where you distort the view of life in such a way where there's terrible, terrible complications, when in reality there is no complication, where the straight person is very smooth. Why? Because there are no complications in his own mind. There's certain practical things that are sometimes difficult. Difficult things come up in the physical world. So the person that's a yosher, that thinks correctly, that thinks straight, so he'll work it out, he'll come in front of him, he'll deal with it, and that's it in a practical way. But the person with a distorted mind, by a distorted mind it means that he creates problems where there isn't. And where there really is a problem, I mean, he distorts it, I mean, altogether, completely distorts life. You understand? He goes to extremes. So therefore, that is the that is what it means by the crooked person. The quality that stops the lazy person is the quality that creates evil. Okay. Verse 20 says, "The son, a wise son makes his father happy, and the foolish man mocks his mother." The question is why doesn't the foolish son mock his father, and why doesn't the wise son make his mother happy? The foolish son, in other words, a person that's a fool is, in other words, we're talking about that he has a certain vicious streak in him, so usually these people are cowards, and therefore they only attack a person that backs off. And it's usually, not all the time, but usually it is the mother that's usually the nice one, and it's not the disciplinarian usually. So therefore it comes out that the child feels free
especially when the father is not around, he feels free that he could put his mother down. You understand? That is the foolish one. Okay? Now the question is, what does it mean the wise son makes his father happy? Now, the thing is that there are two possibilities in making happy. One is by his existence, the way he exists, that makes him happy. Or the son goes out to make the father happy. He does something because he wants to make the father happy. Okay? Question is, can you prove which possibility we're talking about? The two possibilities again. Either, and when it says the wise son makes his father happy, it could be because he is a wise son, so his father's happy with him. Or it could be that the son goes out to do an act to make the father happy. Okay? So the question is, which one is the correct possibility? So we're going to prove it by opposites, because the second half of the verse says that the fool mocks his mother, he doesn't act. So therefore we're going to have to say the first half, that the wise son does an act towards his father. In other words, like some type, he does good actions, he makes his father happy by doing correct actions to make his father happy, because he is a wise son. Okay? Is that correct? So the question is, so then on the second half, I understand why it says mother. But on the first half, why does it say father? It really should say father and mother, or parent. You understand? Shouldn't make a difference to the wise son. Even before we deal with this problem of the wise son, the question is what is the quality that we're dealing with in the wise son and the foolish son? In other words, there has to be some subject that we're dealing with. Okay? What do you say? So the answer is his attitude. We're dealing with certain attitudes in life. The foolish son, his attitude in life is that I want to have my way and I want to control people. I don't like being controlled. So I stay away from my father and I'll control my mother. You see? The wise son, is his attitude is that I have to appreciate what my parents do for me. I have to make them happy. I have to make them happy because I have to appreciate. I appreciate what they do and I think about what they do for me. So then I have to appreciate that. You're saying? So a certain sense of appreciation. In other words, he recognizes the reality of what his parents do for him, and he has to appreciate it. The foolish son doesn't look at what they do. He only looks at his desire for control, his desire to have his way. It's two different attitudes, you see? It's two different attitudes, okay? So we come back to the original question, why does the pasuk say the father and not the mother? And also Laura asked the question like this, that really that the difference what we're making here, we can make in general, why do we attach it to the son? Why don't we just say in general, the foolish person will give some example, King Solomon will think of a good example, that his desire for control and to put down the weak. And the son, and the wise person, that he recognizes, evaluate exactly what the person does. You understand? If he does good, so he'll do this. If he doesn't, he won't do this. You understand? He'll evaluate. So why does it King Solomon attach it to a son in relationship to parents? Now that's Laura's question. Okay, so Cal wants to say that the thing is that when an authority shows niceness, when an authority gives unconditional love to a young person, the young person, if they're not a chacham, if they're not wise, then they interpret it as a sense of weakness. So therefore, what Cal wants to say that the subject here is education.
Okay? The subject is education. When you're educating a children, most of them start out foolish. I mean, a wise person must come through wisdom. So when you have children, you have to give love, but however, there has to be a certain discipline, because there's no discipline if it's unconditional love. Then the child, I mean, you have to watch. If you can give unconditional love and the child doesn't take advantage of it, so then it's fine. But if you start noticing that the child takes advantage of it, so then you must do something to stop that, to make him aware that, because he, in other words, let's put it this way, then you must deal with that part of his personality which interprets niceness as weakness. So maybe the pasuk is telling us that type of idea. In other words, according to you, Cal, that's what the pasuk is telling us, trying to educate us. In other words, we're not talking about the fool. We're not telling, usually the verse is telling us something about the fool and the wise. Here it's telling us in raising a child, you have to know what the child is and know what to do. So if you see that the child is taking advantage of niceness, then you must try to guide the child whatever way, whether with discipline or with education, whatever, depends on the situation. You have to work out, well, according to the nature of the child, how to educate the child. You understand? So that would come out very well, that we're talking to the parent and we're not talking to the children, we're talking to the parent about raising your child. That's very good. But we still have the question with the wise son, why it's only to the father. We just spent a little time going back and forth to find many different reasons why the wise would do an act to the father, and none of them make sense. Okay, we went spent the time on that. All right, so the thing is, what I'd like to say is the only really the wise son would make his parents happy, both father and mother. Of course, if it's for appreciation, he has to appreciate both of them. It's not one over the other, okay? But the thing is, since in the second half we can only use mother, so because of a certain niceness of language, so we use only the father in the first half, even though in reality, I think when it says the wise son would make both, in reality, the wise son would make both his parents happy. In other words, the question is, why didn't King Solomon write openly to parent? Because there's a certain beauty in writing through opposites. Through writing, if you use a certain style in one half, you use another style in the other. And King Solomon would knew that you would be a logical person and recognize that there is no logical possibility why it should be an act towards the father, why the wise son should act towards the father and not towards the mother, you see? And so therefore you would figure it out that it was only a thing of style, so he wasn't afraid you would make a mistake, because he knew that only intelligent people would read this book. Now, the question is, why does it say in the first half a wise son, and in the second half it says a foolish man? Okay? Now, yeah, that's the question. I mean, we're not talking about the same subject. Two different subjects seems to be talking about. Now, there are two possibilities in explaining this, okay? One is that it says the foolish man is because in the eyes of a child, in other words, when he puts down his mother, he recognizes that a child doesn't put down a mother. So he feels like an adult. He evaluates himself that he has the ability to judge his mother. In other words, he's judging that his mother is something bad or whatever it is, and she deserves this. In other words, because she told him not to do something, so she tells him off. So he tells her off because she told him not to do something, right? and because he could get away with it. So therefore, by the word man, it's what he thinks he is. That's one possibility. It's really expressing the imagination of the foolish child. Or it could mean that even if you are a man, you are an adult already. The fact is, you always owe that debt of gratitude to your parents, you see. And so sometimes a person, when they become an adult, they feel the right to tell their parents. In other words, sometimes parents don't do things always correctly, and sometimes when you grow up, you see things that you really notice, like a weakness, you see. But he still, unconsciously, he still relates to the father differently than the mother, even though he's an adult. That's the fool. There's a feeling of difference between the father and the mother, you see? And so therefore, when he becomes an adult and the mother makes a mistake, so then he could find fault with it. Or it could be, if we're talking about adults, then the whole thing between father and mother is really not a distinction at all between father and mother, but really it just really means parents. But that was the style, to write father on one side, mother on the other. But really it means parents altogether. And when you become an adult, then you speak to, you could tell both your parents off, because you feel you're an adult. And so when they do something incorrectly, you feel that you have the right to correct them. And that is wrong. That is wrong. You should never correct your parents. Whatever they're doing wrong, you're in existence because of them. And they stayed up at night when you needed it, and they worked hard to make a living. And anything you have to begin with, and your personality and your genes are theirs, come from them, and you always owe them, and you should always respect them, and you can never tell them off. And that definitely not in a mocking way, you see. So it could be that, according to that explanation, it would be father and mother is only represent parents. And then when a person becomes an adult, so then he feels he has the right to straighten his parents' life out. Okay? So we're saying, no, you don't have the right to do that. That's not right. Whatever they are, you don't have the right to mock them. Even if you feel you could educate them, but definitely to put them down, you don't have the right to. So therefore, just to sum up what we have, I say we have two possibilities. Either it's teaching us a method in education that we should, that when a child comes, that you can't, even though a mother usually gives unconditional love, however, when the child steps out of line, there has to be some type of, in other words, if he takes that, as, the child takes that as a sign of weakness, so then it's teaching us education what to do, that you should not stop it. I mean, you should discipline the child, even if you don't feel like, you should force yourself to control the child, okay? By the Chacham, you don't have to, because he makes the both parents happy. So therefore, you don't have to. Then in that case, you can give unconditional love. Okay. The second possibility, we're talking about that children that are adults. Okay. So therefore, when they're adults, so then there's a certain sense that they look at the parents in a different light from the as an adult, and they might see certain faults even that are real. So you might be able to, whether you could, there's questions of halacha, but leaving halacha out of it, definitely they don't deserve your mocking. I mean, still in all, you owe a debt of gratitude, and therefore you should not mock them. And if you tried to point it out, you should point it out in such a way that you would bypass any hurt feelings of the parents. So therefore, there are two possible interpretations of this pasuk. Right. A chasar lev. A chasar lev is a person that lacks seichel. A chasar lev is a person that lacks intelligence. So to the person that lacks intelligence, he enjoys foolishness. Okay? And the man of tevuna, of understanding, walks in a straight path. The question is, what does it mean altogether? What do you mean, if you lack intelligence, why does he enjoy foolishness? I mean, what does it mean? Okay, that's the first question. Right. The Rabbeinu Yonah formulates the question of opposites like this. The person that, really the opposite of, that you're happy with foolishness would be a person that's happy with truth. And he says the person that's really happy with truth is a tzaddik. Okay, not an ish tevuna. An ish tevuna, a thinking man of understanding, is not yet on the level that he enjoys the truth that much. So therefore, the real enjoyment of truth and justice and straightforwardness would be a tzaddik. So therefore, he says the opposites don't match, because we're talking about two different things. One is talking about happy, and the other one is talking about a straight path, which is, doesn't deal with happiness. We're not talking about happiness. So the question is, what are the opposites here? Right. The first half is a person that lacks intelligence means that he looks at life incorrectly. And if somebody does a stupid act, he might think it's a good act. Like, for instance, a kid that cuts class and he gets away with it. So everybody looks at him as something, wow, that's a great thing. Like, wow, that was a smart thing to do. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, really, he's ruining his life. You understand? So how could you be happy with it? You understand? He looks at foolish things that he does in a happy way. You understand? When he does things that have really the consequences are wrecking his life, when he looks at it as something really good. You understand? So that's what the first half of the verse is saying. Okay? So he's happy with the foolishness. In other words, where the wise person sees consequences, the foolish person sees, wow, that's a great, he praises that which leads to terrible consequences. He looks in a great way. That's really where a large part of the mistakes of the fool is because his value system is to just look at the present. So since he's just looking at the present, what he's doing seems to be a great thing, because that he's doing which what he enjoys, what he's drawn to. So therefore, that looks like a great thing, you see? So therefore, he says, wow, look how great it is. That is what the first half of the verse is saying. In other words, we're talking about the second half. In other words, the ish tevuna, when he sees the consequences of his actions, so he doesn't do it, or he does do something to protect himself in the future, but he's in conflict, he's not happy with it. There's a certain level, which is a higher level, which is which the Rabbeinu Yonah says is tzaddik. So therefore, on that level, now he's happy with truth and reality, that he's living the realistic life. That's a certain level of development. But the Rabbeinu Yonah says the man of Tevuna doesn't have it. And the verse seems to point to it, because it doesn't say the man of understanding is happy with what he is doing. He says he walks in the straight path, but it doesn't say happy. Why doesn't it, should the opposite of the first half should be he's happy with justice, he's happy with doing the rational thing, he's happy with protecting himself, with doing the practical to protect himself, and he becomes attached to practical, and he enjoys doing the practical acts. You see, that's the tzaddik. But the man of Tevuna isn't there. He's still in conflict, according to the Rabbeinu Yonah. So if that's true, that's why the verse says he walks in a straight path. He walks in a straight path, but he's still in conflict, but he's not happy with it. But if that's true, that in that statement, that idea should not be in this verse, because the verse, half of the verse, is talking about that the person that lacks intelligence is happy with his foolishness. So the, where is the contrast? Again, on the first half, it means he's happy because he's always satisfying his emotions, that his immediate emotions, he's always satisfying. So therefore, since he's satisfying his immediate emotions, so he's always happy with it. One of the possibilities is given, what the opposites are, is that the person that lacks intelligence satisfies his emotions, but the other side, the Ishtavuna, doesn't satisfy his emotions, okay? So if that's true, then we're telling you a negative, in this verse, we're pointing out a negative, in other words, a good reason why you should not be a man of intelligence, because you'll be in conflict. I mean, it's hard to say that, I mean, King Solomon might want to point out that in the future you will be happy, so he might do that, so he should talk about the tzaddik, that in the future you will be. But to stop and point out a conflict and not clarify that, I mean, that would be a bad thing. He's just leaving it that it's bad to be a person of understanding because you'll be in conflict, if that's the opposite. So it can't be that. It has to be something positive. The opposite of enjoyment could be hate. You understand? In other words, one person enjoys foolishness and one person hates foolishness. In other words, when you start out, you do the right thing and you still enjoy foolishness. But you do the right thing. You control your desire for foolishness. But then after a while, you see the stupidity of it. So when you reach the intelligent person, the tvuna, which we're calling an intelligent person, the intelligent person reaches a stage before his enjoyment of this life, he has a stage where he hates foolishness. So the contrast is love of foolishness and hatred of foolishness. You see, that's the contrast. Okay? So therefore, he's saying the Ishtavun is a person that the, in other words, the first level when you see the life of truth, you say, look, practically I have to do it, but I'm still drawn to the, that's probably the Chacham. The Chacham, he's still drawn to the life of foolishness. When you first start out, you just can't get rid of that life, but the mind tells you, I have to move this direction, but I'm in conflict because of this. You see? The Ishtavuna really gets out of the conflict. But he is not happy with his life, but he reached a point where he hates foolishness. But he's not content yet and happy with his life. That's the tzaddik. The enjoyment is a level of when you reach the level of tzaddik. But the intelligent person has made a move away from the foolishness in the fact that he hates foolishness. He sees the stupidity in it, and he's constantly afraid that it's going to affect him, that the desire, he still has the desire, so he's afraid that the foolishness is going to affect him. He's afraid of it, and he hates it, because he sees the stupidity of it. The Chacham didn't reach the level of that level where he hates it. He still can see enjoyment, and he's in terrible conflict between his mind, what his mind tells him, what his emotions. Here, he's making a move. His emotions are making a move towards intelligence in the sense that it hates foolishness. So the contrast is that the first half loves foolishness, and the Ishtavuna, the intelligent man, hates foolishness. That's the contrast. There's a difference of opinion difference of opinion in what is a miracle. Now sages say that at twilight between the creation and the existence of the physical world as we know it today, just before, in other words, the twilight of creation, just before we started the laws of nature as we know it today, God created 10 things, okay? Created 10 things that he would need in the future. One was the stick of Moshe, one was the talking donkey of Bilam, one was the, whatever, there were 10 different things. Okay, those particulars. Okay, the question, first thing I'd like to answer is, what does it mean by twilight? What does it mean, twilight? Twilight means it's neither day nor night, right? It's not a definite thing. Now, the thing is that the laws of nature, in other words, the laws of nature is a system. There are no, all the particulars is a result of the system. These 10 things were created, the particulars were created. In other words, that's why it's really not completely in line with the rest of the system. It's twilight. It's not exactly precise, because God built the world with wisdom. Wisdom means systems. And these 10 things are not part of a system. They're just a particular was created. Right? The fish of Jonah was one of them. Okay. So that's what our sages say, and what a miracle is. The Rambam says that a miracle is a suspension of the laws of nature. Okay? Suspension of the laws of nature. In other words, not that God created 10 things. Whenever he needed it, he created. He suspended the laws of nature for a short period, and during that period, he created something. Okay? Now, Rabbi Chaik wanted to explain the machlokas. This goes back around 40 years. He wanted to explain the machlokas like this, that really a miracle is a weakness, because really you see God's wisdom not as a magician that he creates particulars or he interferes with the laws of nature, but you see God's wisdom in the system, you see? So this is a weakness. In other words, because of the human condition, God needed for the human condition sometimes things that didn't always fit in with the system, so he had to interfere with the system. The question is, which weakness is less of a weakness? Where God created the particulars at time of creation, so that once after creation is complete, the system works perfectly and those things were there in place and he doesn't create anymore, so he uses those particulars? Or is it better to suspend the laws of nature? So the machlokas is, the argument is, which is the least weak of the, in other words, a miracle is a weakness in the system. Question is, which is the least weak? In other words, there's a system insofar as when God performs a miracle. It's not arbitrary that God performs a miracle, but there are certain situations which he performs a miracle. That you could define as a system. But the miracle, but the machlokas, the disagreement over here between our sages and Maimonides, is in the miracle itself. Okay? That's not part of the system. The miracle itself is not part of the system. Okay? I would like to give a different possibility in the understanding of the machlokas. Okay? God knows the future. Okay? But however, for instance, let's say, for instance, God knows that you're going to do something good or bad in the future, because God knows the future. So the thing is God will not use his knowledge of the future to punish you or reward you now until after you do the act. In other words, so God doesn't use his knowledge of the future to reward or punish you. Okay? That we see by different cases in the Chumash. In the Tanakh also. Okay. But what we also see that he does use his knowledge of the future to give us Musar. He tells us that about destruction or about that we'll come back to Eretz Yisrael when we're in exile. So he either tells us the consequences of our actions in the particular exactly what's going to happen. That's to help us repent. Or if we're broken, so then he'll tell us that in the future you will come back to Eretz Yisrael, and at one time there'll be a Messiah. So there is. So he builds up our hope. So he uses the for telling us for our benefit to give us Musar about it, to tell us to either rebuke or to help us build when we're in a bad shape, to help build our weakness. When we're emotionally bad shape, so therefore he does tell the future. Okay? Question is, let's say God knows that you're going to do a terrible thing and you deserve a certain punishment. Could God set up the laws of nature beforehand? Could he affect the laws of nature beforehand so as that you will be rewarded or punished after the act? Okay? God can do anything, but the question is, how does he relate to us? So can he relate to us according to his system? Can he relate to us by setting up beforehand that a reward, the laws of nature that will be needed for your reward or punishment beforehand, or he can't do it till after you do it? That is the machlokas, that is the disagreement between our sages and the Rambam. Our sages hold that yes, you could set up beforehand, God could set up beforehand, and based on the knowledge, what he knows what will happen, but he can't actually punish you or reward you until you do it, but he could set up the laws of nature that'll happen beforehand. The Rambam holds, no, that he cannot set up beforehand the laws of nature. Even the laws of nature he can't set up until you actually do the act. Then either he could perform a miracle immediately, or if he wants to punish you in 5 years, so he could set up the laws of nature that in 5 years you will be punished. But that's only after the act. So according to the second way, which we're saying, so we're talking about how God, we're not talking about miracles, we're talking about how God, the first way, the subject, the way we're defining it, the subject is miracles, the machlokas. According to the second way, the way we're defining it, we're talking about God's relationship to people insofar as reward and punishment is concerned. In other words, how God relates to us, what he can use, his knowledge of the future, what he can use before or after. In other words, that knowledge of the future, what he could use and what he won't use for the knowledge of what he has of the future. That's the two ways of setting up the machlokas. We're going to do Proverbs chapter 15, verse 22. Okay? And it says, your thoughts are removed if you do not have advice. And with many advisors, you will make firm. In other words, the opposite, you'll make firm your thoughts. Your thoughts will become firm. Okay. Alright, once again, we're going to translate it once again. Without advice, your thoughts are removed. Okay? With many advisors, it's established or it's made firm. It's kept firm. Okay? Okay. Right, the first question is, the first half doesn't seem to be true. You could think things through without advisors. The question is, what does advice do? How does advice help? Okay? The purpose of advice is to either point out possibilities that you're not aware of, or to point out mistakes the way you're thinking. Okay? Basically, an advisor is there to tell you what you don't know. If he's telling you what you do know, then I don't need him. You understand? So he's there to point out what I don't know. Okay? Is that correct? So at least we could see what emotion, by that description, what emotion stops you from asking advisors. Because by definition, an advisor has to point out things that either you don't know or you're making a mistake about. Right? So therefore, if you have an ego and you feel, I know everything, so this would pull down your ego. You don't want advisors. Okay? But the question is it possible to think out correctly without advisors? Is it possible? The answer is no. That was your question before, that you could think out correct things. No, you can't. It's practically impossible. Ramosha Feinstein says that a person should always discuss things with people that have more knowledge than him. Says, what if you're the Gadol Hador? That was the situation. Says, so speak to others, the people that are lower than you, but you have to speak to others, because since you're emotionally involved, you're going to miss points. He didn't say those exactly that, but he says you should always have advisors. You should always talk it over with people, because there's always points you could miss. But the emotion that doesn't allow you to do this is because that's the very emotion that they have to point out things that you don't know, or point out where you're wrong. You have to be able to accept that. You understand? That's the difficulty. That's the emotion that that King Solomon is talking about. There is one more point. The pasuk doesn't talk about it, but sometimes if you have two possibilities among advisors, you're going to have to make a decision. So you, no matter, in other words, if all the advisors say the same thing, so then it becomes no problem. But if the advisors tell you two different things, then at some point you're going to have to use your intuition, or if you don't have a proof of one over the other, after all the arguments, there's no proof and there's just two logical possibilities, then your logic and your thought must make the final decision. In other words, you don't accept what advisors do, but they open your mind to things that you would not have thought of. But in the final analysis, you have to make the decision in your own life. You can't let other people make decisions in your life. In other words, that's the opposite problem, where people have advisors because they don't want to make decisions. They'd rather leave it for others to make decisions. That is not the purpose of advisors. Okay? The purpose of advice is to open your mind, but in the final analysis, you have to make the decision. The question is let's say, for instance, there are certain situations where you should let others make a decision. Let's say in Pesach, go to a rabbi, he paskins for you. Go to a doctor, he advises you. Okay? So the question is, let's say, there are cases where you should, right? Let's say two doctors tell you to do two different things, okay? And there's no way of proving, you cannot prove one over the other. Whose advice are you going to take? In other words, I'll give you an example. Let's say, for instance, two doctors say two opposite things, but you're able to notice that one doctor is a greater genius than the other. So again, you're making a decision which one, based on your knowledge of the authority, because he's a greater genius, so therefore he'll have insight that the other doesn't. So therefore you follow the guy with the greater genius, so therefore you're also making the decision. In other words, either way, you're always making a decision. You always have to make a decision. Even if it's an authority, the question is, why are you accepting one authority over another?